the storm's development and intensity. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 83 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 74 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Spangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Nana Show. Today, I want to share with you a couple of clips that relate to news that have been that relates, of course, to Gaza. We're all about Gaza right now until this genocide ceases or this empire collapses. First of all, I wanted to there's a quite a startling interview with a genocide scholar from Burma. His name is Dr. Mong Zarni, and he had a brief interview upon his return from Gaza and observing what's happening there. And I felt that it was, you know, he wasn't mincing words when talking about it, unlike our government, especially the Democrats that have perfected the lies about it and perfected deflection, basically, this administration. For those of you who love that brat, that butcher brat, it's all about deflection and her performance yesterday. Everybody's praising her performance. If you see it from a humanitarian point of view, you see one candidate talking about immigrants eating animals, a lie. And then you talk about, you have on the other hand, a cold calculated candidate supporting the genocide and prioritizing the most deranged country, the most demented people in the world, the Israelis. As worthy of defense, as worthy of the billions of dollars that we're taking from our coffers and putting them into theirs. One note before we go to that first clip is that the reason why I found this interview with this Burmese genocide scholar really interesting is because I spent 3 years in Tacoma Park, where, you know, these liberals that call themselves progressive except for Palestine, they don't call themselves, we call them that. They tend to champion things like Burma. That's what I love about this interview, is there's actually, I believe, one point they've, you know, the city council in Tacoma Park voted to restrict things that are coming from Burma at the time because of the human rights violations that were happening, but nothing from Israel, even though that city, by the way, I don't know if you know the history. Basically, the culture of Tacoma Park, the progressive culture, was sparked by a Syrian mayor, Abbott, whose pictures still feature in some of the businesses in Tacoma Park. So despite the fact that it's founded on a mayor that was a radical leftist humanitarian mayor, these progressives except for Palestine will champion Burma, but always look at Arabs and Palestinians as subhuman, even though they would never admit to that. Of course, liberals would never admit to something like that. So Here, let's with that. I would just wanted to see from the horse's mouth what the Burmese genocide scholar would tell Tacoma Park activists. So let's listen to that clip.
Israel is the most vicious type of settler colonialism. Everything that is wrong with the human civilization, Israel has mastered and institutionalized it.
Dr. Maung Zani is a Burmese genocide scholar. He spent the last 9 days visiting both Israel and Palestine as part of an interfaith delegation. He sat down with me to discuss his observations upon having meeting a wide range of Israelis and Palestinians to discuss the current situation. Can you give us a kind of a bird's eye view of what you took away from the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians?
I'm still reeling from the shock of being there for 9 days, and then on the 10th day we left the country. I've never seen a situation where genocidal paradigm or policies and practices are so creatively pursued and so total. In other words, what I've discovered there, it's what I would call a vast ecosystem of genocidal methodologies with a comparative understanding of different genocides in history as well as in different geographies, like in Cambodia. I spent like a 3+ years conducting mass grave tours at different killing fields when I was trying to influence the influencers in the country, in Burma. I came from Burma, or Myanmar, if you want to call it, where we, the Buddhist majority, were cheerleading and supporting the Burmese military's, full-scale genocide of Rohingya Muslims. And I have studied extensively Nazi ideology, the methods they use, Nazi genocide, personalities involved, right? The dynamics within the German society. I've also traveled across Bosnia-Herzegovina, where multiple, genocidal killings took place. If you come in a situation like Palestine, and the land and is administratively and from a security perspective divided into different areas, walls, checkpoints, deliberately, differential or discriminatory practice of very, very unequal resource distributions, resources that are essential to life or to sustain life, like water, land, access to food systems, right? And then you've got, the complete impunity, that settlers, basically land thieves. Yeah. The settlers, very euphemistic term. We're talking about land thieves, right? Sponsored by the state of Israel as a matter of policy, protected by what Netanyahu would call the most moral army, the Israeli Defense Force. Local call it Israeli Oppressive Force. A friend of mine, a genocide scholar in Australia, called the IDF Israeli Death Force. This ecosystem of genocidal practices, which include, systems of apartheid, colonial occupation, racist supremacist institutions and judicial system, extremely racist or genocidally racist ideology that permeates across different sectors of Israeli society. So this is a complete genocide that is even beyond what Nazi Germany had embodied. I say this because, extreme sadism and torture methods, right? That's straight from Inquisition. Genocide as essentially a process with the singular purpose of destroying a nation or a population under occupation by the occupier. The checkpoints. The purpose of checkpoints isn't simply that Israel needs to defend itself and needs to feel safe or safer. The checkpoints are set up to make life unpredictable. You can't really plan. Like you have a business meeting about 2 miles away from your home. You drive towards the checkpoint, that checkpoint's closed. You've got to go around and spend like 45 minutes or like a 1 hour. That's like your bottleneck, you know? We see like graffitied walls with sniper towers. You know, it's like a Benthamite prisons, really, with panopticons, you know, where like, you know, as if like, you know, you are being watched 24/7 from all angles. Mm. There might just be just one sniper sitting up there, right? But that's just like a really snapshots of like walls and, you know, sniper tower. If you take a total length of the wall, you realize this is like, you know, 810 kilometer long wall. Yeah. And that wall is really established to create this, you know, vast prison camp. You know, you can go about your business there until the IDF arrives, you know, unannounced and like you pick up your son or daughter, you're gone, right? Mm. But in 2005, the United Nations Commission on the Wall investigated the wall and its impact on the sustainability of life for Palestinians. And what they discovered is that the wall is a major driver or factor behind production of mass poverty among this population. You know, we're talking about millions, right? And then, you know, the other element I found is what the father of genocide, Raphael Lemkin, who actually coined the term genocide, called racial underfeeding in populations or nations under occupation. Palestinians are not just simply occupied spatially. Their lives are occupied, right? You know, I took a Palestinian public bus, a bus meant for a Palestinian, and at checkpoints, like, you know, everyone, old, young, babies, infants, toddlers, every one of us, including foreigners like myself, and, you know, we were ordered to get off the bus and show ID, you know, queue up in front of like a team of IDF soldiers, anti-terror units, you know, whatever, local police, they're different uniforms, like, you know, all fully armed with automatic the submachine guns, and you know, little babies with mother, you know, approach the Israeli IDF person, you know, and everyone comply fully, and I noticed, you know, their eyes cast downward. And they, you know, they feel they had no other option but to comply. What I find shocking is that in addition to the Israeli state and its policies making Palestinians' life extremely difficult in terms of their access to land and food system and land confiscation, all that, water is, you know, in a desert-like situation, water is so crucial. There's a museum in one of the refugee camps next to the wall called Banksy Museum. Banksy, you know, the graffiti artist from England. There is a comparative cross-section of two different types of pipes that were used to supply water to a Palestinian population and to the Israeli population. Very short time, right? Plus diseases, right? And that have put Palestinian life at extreme dangers, you know, the preventable diseases, destruction of health system. That is a classic genocidal extermination in Gaza. And then you've got this, like, you know, classic apartheid in certain parts of, like, the occupied territories. And then you've got classic colonial occupation and so-called pacification campaign. So they're, you know, different major elements of previous historical crimes, apartheid, crimes against humanity, war crimes, you know, settler colonialism, erasure of like memory, names, right? And when you see this as part of a total whole, just different inventive and specific methodologies, but with the singular purpose to turn this slogan, you know, land without people. So this was the slogan from the very get-go of the Zionist movement. And that slogan is being turned into a self-fulfilling prophecy using this ecosystem of various genocidal methods. Different subpopulations of, you know, the Palestinian are subject to different types of repression and destruction, full destruction, partial destruction, potential destruction, and coming destruction. This could be, you know, Palestine could turn into a something like a Rwanda situation, you know, but all of a sudden, the IDF may not be the main killer, you know, the settler violence is unleashed, you know. Now Israeli settlers are all armed. They're using the settlers as the spearhead of Israeli violence outside of Gaza. And of course, like in Gaza, it's the IDF that is the spearhead of the genocide with American weapons, American monies, and European Union money, you know, the Britain even. This is the most comprehensive and complete genocide. It's not just single acts, but if you have to look at them, look different policies and practices of Israel as being interconnected with the singular purpose of taking the land without people. It has everything, all the elements of historical crimes that we witness in, you know, settler colonial genocides across North America, Latin America, Australia, like South, you know, and Africa. Everything is there, man. Israel is the embodiment of all elements of crimes, with the exception of slave trade and slavery, yeah, that we have witnessed the Christian Europe committed over the last 500 years against the people of color around the world. Israel is the worst form of, you know, genocidal regime. That's why, like, you know, Professor Noam Chomsky, who used to live here in his youth in the 1950s in kibbutz, right? He finally said Israel is the most vicious type of settler colonialism. Everything that is wrong with the human civilization, Israel has mastered and institutionalized it.
Tell us about the actual interactions that you had with Palestinians and Israelis. So you spent time in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Were you able to meet with Palestinians? And if so, what was their feelings and attitudes towards the situation that we're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I had, like, you know, talked to different Palestinians from across section of the Palestinian society, right? Like kids in refugee camps, you know, the shop owners, university students, NGO activists, you know, faith leaders, you know, from Lutheran Church, like other Christian denominations. And also I also talked to the, we visited Al-Aqsa Mosque and, you know, talk to the prayers there, if, you know. In West Bank, what strikes me is that although West Bank is nominally under the Palestinian Authority administration, you know, the common view is that Palestinian authorities are at best completely impotent, you know, to protect the Palestinian population there, at best. And at worst, Palestinian authorities is really, you know, serving as a local controller of Palestinian people, their own people, for Israel. I don't make these words up. That's like, you know, when you sit down and, you know, chat with them, the locals say Palestinian authorities controlling us for Israel. That's rather damning. And then, you know, and someone like even said, oh, we're under double occupation. I mean, that, you know, that I was shocked, you know. And what we're looking at is, like, you know, basically like a Nazi Germany-like situation, right? Because like people, the Western media and you know all the politicians and you know even the Israeli people, yeah, they're blaming everything on Netanyahu. But Netanyahu is, you know, riding the beast of a thoroughly Zionized or Zionist society. The way Israeli talked about Palestinian, you know, I struck up conversations with fellow passengers in Tel Aviv on a tram or buses, and they would say, Palestinian people, oh, you know, they're miserable people, they're in deep poverty, you know, they're not the problem, but it's their leaders. And then it turned out that that's a standard narrative that Israel has circulated, right? Like, okay, that don't say anything racist about the Palestinian, just focus on the organizations and politicians, right? But they don't talk about 810 kilometer long wall that has massively impoverished and dispossessed and also settlements, right? Like the displacement, the use of terror, right? None of this is, you know, insofar as the Israelis' public opinion is concerned, you know, from my reading, my limited interaction, Israeli public feels they are moral. And I think that one woman used the term moral code. Well, Netanyahu had broken the moral code. I was like, well, like, what kind of moral code Netanyahu broke? I was like, well, he needed to save the, you know, hostages, rescue them. Or like, you know, we don't leave in our Jewish or Israeli Jewish society, we don't leave our people in distress or in need or at risk alone. We have to do it. So, but their sense of moral obligation does not extend to any Palestinian that they have terrorized for the last 75 years, you know, from whom they have taken land, you know, and or like whose villages they destroyed. You know, the last count, like, you know, one of the local historians told me, the last count of the villages destroyed in Nakba is 609. And 11 Palestinian cities were depopulated, right? This is classic Hitlerite depopulation. The policies of the Israeli authorities is to make Jerusalem majority Jewish enclave, you know, excluding erasing Jerusalem's multi-faith, multi-ethnic, multi-racial, inter-civilizational tradition. The Jews, the Muslims, and, you know, the Christians of different denominations, right? It's a holy site, but they want to make it, you know, almost exclusively, you know, Zionist state, because like we cannot conflate Zionism with Judaism. There are so many like Jewish people who feel extremely offended by the fact that, you know, the Israel is committing this or set up this ecosystem of genocidal, you know, methods in their name. Land without people. When they knew there were like 95% of the population there was native, you know, like Arabs, you know, Palestinians of different religion, you know, even including the Jewish population, right? There. And so I think what we are seeing is that Israel's pursuit of its singular overarching project of, you know, taking the land without the people. I've never seen, you know, this level of, you know, terroristic and sadistic violence. Israel systemically and systematically cheating the international law.
You spent 9 days in Palestine. You were able to speak with Palestinians in different parts of both Israel and Palestine. What was the message that you think they wanted the world to hear?
Well, they want, you know, first and foremost, they want to stop the genocidal onslaught in Gaza. It's going on for 11 months. And that's the most immediate, because everyone's affected, you know, although they're like, you know, 100 or 200 kilometers away from Gaza, they are still affected by, you know, what they witness as their fellow Palestinian being essentially exterminated, yeah, by, you know, airstrikes and diseases and all this stuff, right? And secondly, they want Israel to comply with the International Court of Justice, you know, advisory ruling, not just once, twice. that the occupation is totally against international law. Israel needs to, you know, remove all the settlements. In other words, Israel needs to take 750,000 or close to 800,000, you know, land thieves, you know, euphemistically described as settlers from Palestinian land, right? And then Palestinians are not talking about, all right, let's go back to, you know, one Palestine. Well, you know, okay, maybe like that, that may be you know, what some people advocate as one Palestine, right? And but I don't see, with the level of dehumanization, with the level of hatred and disgust and, you know, the low opinion that Israeli public hold their cohabitants, the Palestinians, I don't see reconciliation, you know, in a single state. It has to be two state. But of course, like, you know, but I'm just an outsider, you know, who am I to say what's best for them? But insofar as they're concerned, they want the end to occupation. They want to dismantle the wall. They want to dismantle the system of checkpoints. They don't want to be under Israeli occupation. That's been for 57 years, since 1967. Simple. So what what Palestinians want? Immediate ceasefire in Gaza, end to occupation, yeah, and withdrawal of, you know, nearly 1 million, you know, land thieves, land thieving, you know, Israeli communities off their soil. Simple.
That was a segment by a genocide expert from Burma, who was explaining what was happening in Gaza when he went to visit recently. And he went both to Gaza and the West Bank, and to Jerusalem, of course. And you could see that, you know, if you go there, you can't help but speak plainly and openly, because you have to tell the truth, because the travesty that you witness there cannot be minced. We can't mince words about it. So with that, I also wanted to address another issue that happened in the past week and relates to the clip that you're about to listen to from Electronic Intifada. There are two things I wanted to say about that. One is, this has to do with the recently with the Turkish American young woman that was working with the International Solidarity Movement, the same International Solidarity Movement that Rachel Corey had worked with, who was a young woman from Washington State who was basically run over by a bulldozer and then backed up on her as she was defending a Palestinian home from demolition. In this case, this was a Turkish activist with the International Solidarity Movement that was defending a home. And at some point they had to move away because there was live ammunition and tear gas. And as these people from different countries stood up, stood aside and hundreds of yards away from the where the fire was, where the tear gas was being thrown and live ammunition was being shot, and suddenly the Turkish American woman gets shot in the head by a sniper that has plain view from above of these handful of activists that were waiting by the sideline. It's obviously an openly an assassination, a killing of an American citizen. But, you know, this American citizen was defending Palestinians. Therefore, you know, that's why Biden feels necessary to say this happened by accident, because he thinks of Arabs and Turks and Middle Easterners in general as subhuman. He's a racist, and so is Harris, and so are these These people that are holding press conferences like Kirby, and saying we're waiting on an investigation. They're waiting on an investigation by the state of Israel, who has proven to be to have to lie to provide a lie a day, one big lie a day since the start of this conflict over 300 days ago. This is just fodder for the American, for the gullible American people. The in general, Americans are actually against this type of thing, and of course need to would support a real independent investigation of what happened, which would show you that it was obvious an open assassination. But there is no red lines for Israel, and they'll continue to do this. Secondly, I wanted to mention that the clip that you're about to listen to is from Electronic Intifada, and it addresses this issue that I just talked about the fact that killing of Americans does not matter to our government, does not matter to our Congress people, with the exception of you like Rashida Tlaib. Does not matter to Harris, does not matter to Biden, does not, of course, matter to Trump. The Electronic Intifada has been reporting on these things, and YouTube decided, Electronic Intifada has a live stream every Wednesday, and YouTube decided to shut down their live stream, even though the Electronic Intifada, there's nothing that they put out that is not well researched and multi-sourced. But this is a clip from 4 days ago where they reported on the killing of this Turkish American activist in the occupied territories. So let's have a listen.
Ali, what can you say about the State Department's willingness or lack thereof to even consider arms export bans or restrictions?
And of course, Ace's points are well taken about this being largely cosmetic in the UK. But people should take it and demand more. Just the same as what happened in Canada a few months ago when they announced that they were going to not issue any new licenses, but the existing licenses remained in effect. So again, it was sort of a partial move to try to appease public opinion. But this was taken as sort of a precedent that could happen in the US, or people raising the question. And a journalist asked the State Department spokesperson, Matt Miller, about this at yesterday's briefing. And we can watch a short clip from that. Tamara, this would be clip number one.
We are working on a deal to get all of them home.
Okay, I have one more question on the UK's decision to suspend some arms shipments
Yeah, go ahead.
To Israel. Has that.
You can have 8 questions.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
We've all been gone for a
It's
while. We haven't been
fair.
briefing in a while. Has that informed, changed the US's position on whether international humanitarian rights have been violated in Israel? Is the US rethinking any of its arms exports?
No, this is a decision that the United Kingdom made based on its assessment under its own laws. We have our assessments that are ongoing when it comes to looking at possible violations of international humanitarian law, and those continue to be ongoing.
Okay, the last we heard of those publicly was in April with the National Security Memorandum. There's been no update since April about the US's visibility into use of US weapons.
No, it can there continue to be a number of cases that are under review. As you know, it's an ongoing conflict. Oftentimes, when you look when it comes to looking at specific cases, there are differing accounts that we have to sift through to try to gather information about actually what happened. There are, as I said, a number of incidents that are under review, and those remain under review. I don't have any update on them.
Thank you.
So that's
We are working on a deal to get all.
Yeah, so there we have Matt Miller, his first answer. Will the US consider suspending arms export? No. And he actually repeats that again later on. But and then there's all that word salad about, you know, we're still investigating some isolated incidents of whether Israel is misusing American weapons. But it's such a mystery, and those investigations are
ongoing process.
Yeah. Nobody has any idea what's going on in Gaza. Like, there's just no way to tell. And it's an ongoing process that takes forever. But the reason, of course, it's no surprise. I mean, Kamala Harris came out as we covered last week and the week before and said no arms embargo in Israel. Joe Biden, no arms embargo in Israel. They've been clear about that. But the reason why I'm highlighting this now, even though it's not new, is because in the last few days, there's been this news that in the next, I don't know when, he's going to take his own sweet time, because for the people of Gaza can wait forever, apparently. Joe Biden is going to come out with a final take it or leave it ceasefire deal, which Israel and Hamas are going to have to just make up their minds. They have to take it or leave it. And of course, what Matt Miller is signaling here is, if you're giving an ultimatum, well, what's you're taking off the table any possible leverage or pressure with Israel. And you're saying to Israel, this is take it or leave it. But if you don't take it, we're just going to keep supplying you with the bombs, the bullets, the weapons to keep doing what you're doing. There are going to be no consequences. So this again just underscores that the whole idea that the U.S. government, and whether that be Joe Biden or Kamala Harris, that they're working tirelessly for a ceasefire, to use the words of AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is just utter nonsense. There, no serious effort to pressure both sides would take off the table the notion of an arms embargo or suspending some arms, and that's what Matt Miller just did. So this whole, you know, the whole notion of the take it or leave it offer is just completely ridiculous. There's nothing new. Hamas has responded to this news, by the way. I watched that Matt Miller press briefing, the whole thing, so that nobody else has to. But he spent a large part of it pairing with journalists who are saying, well, what does it mean, a final take it or leave it offer? What's final about it? Mm-hmm. What happens if it doesn't work? Does that mean there's going to be no more effort to get a ceasefire? And he spent all this time trying to define the meaning of final or not answer the questions. It just shows how unserious they are. But, you know, Hamas's response, which was given by Osama Hamdan in an interview with Al Jazeera yesterday, was simply that we don't need any more initiatives. There was already the initiative that President Biden laid out at the beginning of May and that we accepted. And then there were some amendments the following month and we accepted those. So, you know, if they want that, that's the initiative. There is going to be no deal that doesn't meet the basic requirements of the resistance and of the Palestinian people, which is an end to the war, not just a pause so that Israel can go back to killing people after they get the Israeli captives out, those who survive, an end to the war, an end to the siege, a humanitarian aid, people going back home, and of course, a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, including the Netzarim corridor and the Philadelphia corridor, which, as John explained to us, Netanyahu this week, perhaps worried that a deal could happen, decided to up the ante and say, oh, we're never leaving the Philadelphia corridor. And of course, that means no possibility of a deal. But interestingly, just in the last day or two, I think we have that story somewhere, or I did, on my screen.
Oh, the plans for the Rafah crossing?
Well, that's one of them. But the other one is, this one. I'm going to drop this in the chat, Tamara. And this is just sort of in the last, developed over the last, overnight in the last few hours, of Israel, or at least some Israeli officials, because we don't know who actually speaks for Israel these days, other than Tony Blinken. He seems to be the only person who can tell us what Israel has agreed to and what it hasn't. But this story from the Times of Israel and also it's been reported in Haaretz and in some other press, that Israel is trying to backtrack from Netanyahu's position that we're never leaving the Philadelphia corridor by saying, well, we will leave, but it won't be until the second phase or the third phase or whatever it is. So they're trying to backtrack. But Nora, yeah, you were pointing out the conditions that
right.
the U.S. might try to impose on the Rafah crossing, which of course is the crossing with Egypt, between Gaza and Egypt, that is at the so-called Philadelphia corridor. What did the Washington Post say about that?
Right. So I'm reading from Al Mayadeen, the Lebanese publication that kind of summarized the Washington Post. So I don't have to click the Washington Post. But Al Mayadeen, I think we have the link. Anyway, Al Mayadeen says a senior U.S. official has disclosed that the formation of a Palestinian force trained by the United States is emerging as the most likely U.S.-led solution for securing the Rafah crossing, as reported by the Washington Post. This development aligns with the European Union's readiness to resume its role in monitoring the Rafah crossing in cooperation with the Palestinian Authority, according to the U.S.-based newspaper. So, I guess I had forgotten that the European Union had a kind of temporary role as hall monitor after the Oslo Accords at the Rafah crossing.
Well, it was actually in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
It was an EU mission called EUBAM, European Union Border Assistance Mission. And the point of this was, again, as the Palestinian Authority does, as the EU did in that setting. You know, when you go to the crossings at the between Jordan and the West Bank, and you go through, where Palestinians go through, Palestinians are actually greeted by Palestinian Authority officers wearing Palestinian Authority uniforms who check their documents and everything. But the Israelis are actually behind them, behind one-way glass. And it's the Israelis who actually decide who passes and who doesn't. And this was set up that way in the Oslo Accords, so that they could give the appearance that, oh, look, the Palestinians are in charge of this, when it's really the Israelis who are the puppet masters. And the Palestinian Authority also served that role at the Rafah crossing, and then the European Union stepped in to serve that role too, in the context of the Palestinian Authority being booted out of Gaza following its failed conspiracy with the United States and the United Arab Emirates to take over Gaza after the Hamas won the elections in 2006. So again, we see this fantasy or this idea of the of a collaborator force. An Arab or Palestinian traitor force run by the Americans and the Israelis, acting as a fig leaf for Israel to remain in control without being physically present. And they also, I think, Nora, did they not talk about, you know, remote cameras and everything that Israel would control?
That's right.
I guess my right. question, this is to you, Nora, to John, to anyone, is... who gets the final say here? Does the United States get to decide what happens at the Philadelphia crossing?
I think that's a question for John.
Corridor?
No, they shouldn't. They definitely shouldn't get the final say on that.
Oh, well, we agree they shouldn't. But who does? I'm asking, can these sorts of arrangements be imposed by the United States or even by Egypt if the resistance doesn't agree to them?
No, I would imagine not. The resistance has been very clear about foreign armies coming in to secure any of the systems inside Gaza. They consider that a hostile foreign occupation, And their principle on that is very, very clear. So I would be deeply surprised for that if there was maybe some kind of system where it was just for introductory moments to be passed off. Maybe, who knows, in this moment where genocide is really defining things. But I wouldn't wait and expect to see Hamas sign off on chunks of their territory being put under occupation, or to have a third party country involvement. Right. I just don't, they're not going to do it. I don't right. see that, especially Hamas of all movements. They've watched the failure of the PA doing that and what that means. And I think I would be surprised by that. Yeah. I also would be surprised to see Israel hand the crossing back to Hamas at this point, the way that yeah. the Israelis behave and act. And it's a catastrophe. The closing of the Rafah crossing is a catastrophe.
And it's a potential impasse. And I just want to throw that story up just so people can see it. Tamara, that's, I don't know if we can get it up now. We had a little technical.
I'll put it in the chat. But yeah,
Yeah, it's fine. We can, yeah. we don't need to show it. But it, again, it was the story from the Times of Israel about how now they're trying to find a way to save face and get Netanyahu to back off the insistence on the Philadelphia crossing. Right. But I don't know if we should move on, just given the time. Yeah. I did want to just address, because again, John talked about the apparent execution of the six Israeli soldiers, the prisoners of war in Gaza, one of whom was a dual U.S. American citizen. And of course, there has been a lot of attention to him and his family in the U.S. media and from U.S. politicians, especially since I think his family was actually featured at the Democratic National Convention.
And the State of the Union.
And yeah. the State of the Union. They trotted them out. And, you know, I think even wasn't, was that the prisoner family, that the POW family that AOC also posed for a photo with?
I think so, yeah. They're the most out in front of any of the families.
Yeah, and good for, or sort of deemed useful for advocacy in the United States because of his dual U.S. citizenship. So right. I hope we can show this clip. Again, this would be clip 2, and this is from Matt Miller at the State Department briefing yesterday.
I think we're having some technical difficulties.
Oh, okay. Too bad.
So Hirsch Goldberg wasn't said that he was a soldier. They said all through all the campaign, it didn't say he was a soldier. We knew he was a soldier by doing the basic math. But then when he died, it was immediately photos published of him in combat uniform. And then yesterday in the newspaper, the Jewish Tribune, I think it was, combat soldier Hirsch Goldberg Paulin was called an American for 11 months upon his death. And we see photos of him. This is my language of their thing. We see photos of him, and his mom is saying that he was at Nova blowing off steam after his combat service while he was saving up money to go to Goa, which yeah. is the place that the Israeli soldiers go after their service in Goa, India, to go surf. And they all go like a cliche.
And annoy all the other tourists.
Yeah, they also go to Thailand. It's another favorite destination. But I think we can show this clip now. Let's see.
Publicly.
Yeah.
Now.
Okay, to follow up on Matt's line of questioning about Hamas leaders being brought to justice, I mean, the president said that Hamas leaders will pay for their crimes. You've walked through what that might look like, but when might that happen, considering you need Hamas's leadership sign off on a potential hostage and ceasefire deal in the near term? So when do you expect this justice and payment for crimes to be delivered.
I'm not going to put a timetable on it, but I think the United States has shown that we have a long memory when it comes to bringing to justice those responsible for the death of American citizens.
Okay. Has the U.S. entertained?
Yeah. So that's
selectively.
Yes. Well, what I wanted to point out, of course, is that it depends which U.S. citizens,
right,
really, and who is killing them. So just one correction. AOC was posing with Ruby Ken, who is the father of 19-year-old Israeli-American Itai Ken. So it wasn't Hirsch Goldberg Pollan, just to clarify that. Let's look at, the United States has a long memory when it comes to punishing or bringing to justice those who kill U.S. citizens, according to the State Department. Well, let's put up, Tamara, this EI story I wrote back in January back in 2022. And this was the story about the murder by Israeli forces by a specific unit called the Netzach Yehuda Battalion of a Palestinian elder, Omar Asad, who was killed in his village in the West Bank. A Palestinian-American citizen had worked 40 years to raise his family in the suburbs of Milwaukee, had made enough money to build a home in their village, had returned with his wife to live out their retirement years surrounded by friends and family, and he was murdered in a horrible way as he was on the way home from a relative's house. And he's a U.S. citizen. And if we put up the next link, Tamara, this is from a story from Al Jazeera just from a couple of weeks ago, that after now more than 2 years, this happened his killing was in January, and one of these U.S. investigations went on under the Leahy Law, which is a U.S. law that says that it's illegal, that the United States cannot transfer weapons to foreign military units involved in human rights abuses. And this Netzach Yehuda Battalion is notorious, even among Israeli army units, where there's a lot of competition, notorious for how brutal it is with Palestinians. And at the end of this long investigation, the U.S. decided that it will not put any sanctions on this military unit. So a green light and a license to keep killing. And of course, the U.S., and I wrote about that in my story, the United States has also refused to prosecute, because the U.S. just indicted Hamas leaders for killing U.S. citizens on October 7th. But they are willing to indict people for crimes against Americans in other countries, but they've absolutely refused to indict anyone for the killing of Omar Asad. And let's take two other examples, because apparently it's so outrageous to the Biden-Harris administration that U.S. citizens are being killed overseas. Well, according to Defense for Children International Palestine, among the 70 children Israel has killed just in the West Bank since the start of this year. So we're talking about only the West Bank, because the number of children killed in Gaza is now more than 18,000.
Yeah.
So just in the West Bank, they've killed 70 Palestinian children as of a few days ago, including two U.S. citizens. So 17-year-old Palestinian-American Muhammad Ahmed Khadour, he was killed on February, and the second Palestinian-American child killed by the Israeli army is Tawfiq Hafez Ajak, who was shot and killed on January 19th. as Israeli soldiers and Israeli settler opened fire on him. And we haven't heard the State Department vowing to bring...
Bethesda Theater presents the SOS Band on Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st. Spyro Gyral celebrating their 50th anniversary on Sunday, October 13th, and Norman Brown on Sunday, October 20th. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, September 11th. Here are some headlines. Presidential hopefuls Donald Trump and Kamala Harris faced off last night in their first debate before voters head to the polls in just under 8 weeks. Harris is widely considered to have given a stronger performance as the candidates offered starkly different visions on what they intend to do if elected on issues ranging from the economy to immigration to reproductive rights. Harris promised to restore a federally guaranteed right to abortion, while Trump argued in favor of a state-by-state approach. On immigration, Trump pledged to reinstate strict border policies and launch the largest deportation effort in U.S. history, while Harris defended the Biden administration's border policy and criticized Trump for opposing a bipartisan immigration bill, saying that, quote, he'd prefer to run on a problem instead of fixing a problem, close quote. On the economy, each candidate blamed their opponent for inflation. Trump falsely claimed there was virtually no inflation during his presidency, while Harris said Trump's current economic proposals would increase inflation. In more debate news, former President Donald Trump made at least 33 false claims, compared with at least one false claim from Democratic rival Kamala Harris in last night's presidential debate, according to CNN fact-checker Daniel Dale. To mention just a few, Trump continued to falsely claim that he had won the 2020 election. Trump repeated the myth that has proven to be false that immigrants are coming from mental institutions and insane asylums. And in one of the most inflammatory moments of the night, Trump repeated false rumors that Haitian immigrants in Ohio were abducting and eating pets. Officials say there is no evidence this is happening. Daniel Dale, who has been fact-checking Trump for years, said, quote, a remarkably large chunk of what he said tonight was just not true, and this wasn't like little exaggeration or political spin. A lot of his false claims were untethered to reality, close quote. In more political news, State Senator Sarah McBride won the Democratic primary for Delaware's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, and now has the chance to make history as the first openly transgender person elected to Congress. McBride raised almost $3 million in contributions from around the country after McBride achieved national recognition at the 2016 Democratic National Convention as the first openly transgender person to address a major party convention in the United States. And in climate news, Hurricane Francine is closing in today on the Louisiana coast as a Category 1 storm with over 90 miles per hour winds. The storm is forecast to rapidly intensify and reach Category 2 strength before landfall later today. Life-threatening storm surge along the coast could reach 10 feet in the hardest hit areas, which could see considerable flash and urban flooding. Damaging winds could approach 100 miles per hour. After landfall, Francine is forecast to move northward across Mississippi tomorrow. A state of emergency has been declared by the governors of both Louisiana and Mississippi, with many local leaders ordering or strongly recommending that towns and cities evacuate low-lying coastal areas. Record warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico, a hallmark of